Chapter 16. Organized Common Sense. Carl Richard Lepsius, 1810-84, became professor of Egyptology at the University of Berlin in 1839. With his ordered and logical mind, and after years of studying ancient Egypt, especially Jean-François Champollion's work on hieroglyphs, he was the ideal candidate for a job that required the careful organization of field research. Above all, Lepsius was a scholar who collected both artifacts and data. 3 years after his appointment, he became a leader of a huge German expedition to the Nile, similar to those mounted by Napoleon's scientists half a century earlier. Then Giovanni Belzoni and Bernardino Drovetti had plundered Egypt. See Chapter 2. But Lepsius's objectives were high-minded and ambitious. He was to develop the first history and timescale for the pharaohs, who were known only from Greek writings and fragmentary ancient Egyptian records. With Lepsius, we come to the beginnings of a new era in archaeology that stressed scientific recovery of finds and information about the past. Lepsius began in the Nile Delta in 1842, recording previously unknown pyramids and tombs. He then moved upstream, deciphering inscriptions and carrying out some of the first excavations along the Nile to pay attention to different occupation levels. Lepsius returned to Berlin with 15,000 artifacts, plaster casts of inscriptions, and a mass of information that laid the foundations for serious Egyptology. Between 1849 and 1859, he published a magnificent 12-volume book on the expedition. This remains a standard source on many sites that have now vanished, and is testament to what can be achieved with an orderly mind. Careful organization, responsible, slow-moving excavation, and prompt, detailed publication. Carl Lepsius's reports help trigger a profound change in Mediterranean archaeology. By modern standards, his excavation methods were still rough and ready, but his carefully organized work was pioneering. He surveyed many of the sites he visited and recorded the exact positions of artifacts, something almost unheard of in his day. Lepsius was well aware of the urgent need for better standards of excavation. He spent much of his later career training a new generation of archaeologists who were as much concerned with reconstruction and preservation as they were with digging. One of those was Alexander Kanza, 1831-1914, who was professor of archaeology at the University of Vienna from 1869-1877. Another well-organized field worker, Kanza excavated on the island of Samothrace in the northern Aegean Sea as Heinrich Schliemann was digging into Troy. But while Schliemann excavated as though he were digging potatoes, Kanza went to Samothrace to answer important historical questions, not in search of goodies. Kanza's focus was the shrine of the Kabiri, rather mysterious supernatural beings closely associated with the Greek fire god Hephaestus, who protected sailors. In ancient times, a big festival honoring them drew visitors from all over the Aegean every July, with a sacred play that involved a ritual wedding. The sanctuary itself occupied three terraces on a mountain slope. A winged statue, the Winged Victory of Samothrace, discovered there in 1863, became famous when it was moved to the Louvre in Paris. Kanza excavated the sanctuary in 1873 and 1876. He cleared several structures using advanced excavation techniques that were unknown at the time. His main concern was architecture. An architect was on site throughout the dig, while a photographer recorded the excavations. Two lavishly produced volumes detailed the work there. As Kanza's excavations drew to a close, the Germans turned to Olympia, site of the Olympic Games. Another carefully trained archaeologist, Ernst Curtius, 1814-96, conducted meticulously planned excavations. In an important gesture of respect, the archaeologist gave up all claims to the finds and built a special museum on the site. Between 1875 and 1881, they cleared the Olympic Stadium, with its runners' starting blocks and judges' seats. The excavators uncovered nearby temples with columns that had been shattered by ancient earthquakes, as well as numerous small shrines and lesser buildings. An architect and photographer were always in attendance. Records were accurate and complete, and once again, the excavations were published in comprehensive detail. Both Konza and Curtius set new standards for archaeological excavation and were well ahead of their time. They also paid attention to all finds, both large and small. The Germans realized that the very act of archaeological excavation destroyed sites permanently, which made accurate record-keeping essential. Curtius and Konza were not alone, for others were increasingly disturbed by the widespread destruction. Unfortunately, the sponsors of excavations were anxious to get exciting results, not necessarily to fund the carefully organized research that recorded even minor details. Much archaeology was still in the hands of people with an interest in the past and some private money, but no formal training. Then, just as Curtius finished his work at Olympia, an English general with a passion for artifacts received a fabulous inheritance. He now devoted much of his time to prehistoric sites on his land, and in the process helped revolutionize archaeological excavation. Augustus Lane Fox Pitt Rivers, 1827 to 1900, was an unlikely excavator. A conservative Victorian gentleman, he combined soldiering with being a landowner. In 1880, as a little-known army officer named Lane Fox, he inherited from a rich uncle great wealth and a huge estate at Cranbourne Chase in southern England, on condition that he adopt the surname Pitt Rivers. Lane Fox's inheritance brought him nearly 11,000 hectares and the leisure to do whatever he wanted. Pitt Rivers was a formidable man. Ramrod straight, he was always formally dressed, even on an excavation. His military specialty had been firearms, and this led him to spend years researching how these and other artifacts had developed over time. The general's marriage to Alice Stanley, a baron's daughter, drew him into aristocratic circles, with connections to various intellectuals. Among other things, he proved an expert conference organizer, and this brought him into contact with leading thinkers. He fell under the influence of Charles Darwin's ideas and became obsessed with the notion that, like biological organisms, human tools had evolved. Such evolution produced more efficient and usable toolkits. With his almost unlimited resources, Pitt Rivers could acquire large collections of objects from non-Western societies in all parts of the world. He founded two museums in his lifetime. The first was the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, which still flourishes. The second was on his estate. Both were intended to teach what he had called the process of gradual development. The move to excavation was a logical one for a scholarly, well-read man. Pitt Rivers would certainly have heard of the work of Lepsius and other German excavators who stressed the importance of studying changing architecture and artifacts through time. Pitt Rivers' expertise in military organization made carefully arranged and logically planned excavations quite straightforward. The general would set up his excavations from scratch. Everything was scrupulously organized and would proceed with military-style discipline. Small teams of trained workers did the actual digging, while six supervisors oversaw the work. They had two assistants, one a draftsman, the other a model maker. Comprehensive records documented each layer and the finds discovered in them. Pitt Rivers was a strict taskmaster who insisted that the exact location of every find, however trivial, even animal bones and seeds, must be recorded. His workers were nervous whenever he visited the dig. Pitt Rivers only dealt with his supervisors, or his clerks, as he called them. His eyes would dart to and fro, and he never missed even the smallest detail. An untidy pile of pottery, some tools lying too close to the trench. He would visit, look at some finds, or glance through the site notebooks, his black hat jammed firmly on his head in the wind. Then he would ride off, usually without a word. He began with Bronze Age burial mounds, then moved on to Winkleberry Camp, an Iron Age fort in Hampshire, southern England, where he cut cross-sections of the defenses to date the earthworks on the basis of the objects found in them. In 1884, he dug a Roman military camp, several hectares of low banks, humps, and hollows. Here, he had his workers clear off the topsoil, then dig out the dark irregularities in the white chalk subsoil to trace the outlines of ditches and other structures, such as hearths and pits. No one had used such discolorations before to identify ancient buildings. Throughout each excavation, the general thought in three dimensions, something that is a cornerstone of today's methods. He excavated each site down to bedrock, recording each layer and noting human disturbances of the soil. But he dug narrow trenches, which were filled in as he progressed across the site. Inevitably, then, some features were missed, because larger areas were not exposed at the same time. Nowadays, large trenches, capable of uncovering major features such as hut foundations, are a fundamental feature of any excavation to study the layout of an ancient settlement. But Pitt Rivers was interested in ancient technologies and culture change to the exclusion of virtually everything else. Thus, he included food remains but missed post holes and other evidence of structures. In 1893, he investigated Warbarrow, a long Stone Age burial mound that contained six prehistoric burials. Earlier excavators had simply dug carelessly into burial mounds, then removed the human remains and grave furniture. Pitt Rivers excavated the entire mound, including 16 skeletons. He left a row of earth pillars down the center, which kept the layers intact so that they could be recorded accurately. Exposing all the ground under the mound revealed a rectangular outline of discolorations in the underlying chalk over a large area. These were traces of the wooden uprights of a large building that had once protected six burials. When originally dug by the builders, the Warbarrow ditches were deep, with steep edges. An archaeologist of infinite curiosity, Pitt Rivers left the excavated ditches exposed for 4 years. Then he re-excavated them to see how chalk ditches broke down and filled with sediment after they were abandoned. This venture into experimental archaeology was a major advance on any approach seen theretofore. Indeed, it was not repeated in England until the 1960s, when a team of archaeologists built a copy of a prehistoric earthwork to study its decay over centuries. Pitt Rivers had the funds to publish his excavations in a series of handsome monographs that are now collector's items. He had no patience with archaeologists who dug to find artifacts rather than information. Science, he said, was organized common sense. So was the logical way in which he conducted his excavations. His contemporaries considered him eccentric and were put off by his energy, his rigid behavior, and his inquiring mind. Even in death, he was unusual. He was cremated rather than buried, something almost unheard of in 1900. Almost no one followed up on Pitt Rivers' work until the 1920s. With his military background and passion for organization, he developed excavation as a highly disciplined process of discovery. But the general was self-taught, as were other excavators in Britain and elsewhere. Except for the Germans in the Mediterranean, archaeology was still a casual business. You learned as you went along. Only a few archaeologists even attempted to train students. And those who did were looking for people who were prepared to work hard, not young men seeking adventure. According to J.P. Droop, a little-known British archaeologist who wrote a manual on excavation in 1915, excavation was men's work. And on the whole, it was. Except for a handful of talented women. See Chapter 19. To be an archaeologist near to home required curiosity, at least some interest in the past, and patience. To work overseas with local people called for the same patience and an ability to supervise large numbers of workers. If you were lucky, you served an apprenticeship under an experienced excavator. He might not be a good digger, but you learned by watching and from the mistakes he made. A few better digs, especially on Roman sites, adopted some of Pitt Rivers' ideas. but these were still crude excavations by today's standards. Young Leonard Woolley, a British archaeologist who later became internationally famous for his excavations of royal graves at Ur in Iraq, found himself in charge of a major Roman excavation, even though he had absolutely no experience. See Chapter 20. Almost everyone who was an excavator learned on the job. There were no field schools or courses in archaeological methods. But with their structured minds and organization, Konza, Curtius, and Pitt Rivers led the way.